Ever wonder why the more effort we exert to seek happiness, peace, and fulfillment, the more we may feel depressed, anxious, and empty? We perceive some code tapping within us, but we can't quite decipher its meaning. Our lists of pros and cons, our commitments to daily journaling or hot yoga, our carefully mapped out 5-year plans all begin to dissolve, and we begin to lose hope. But now is when we are the most ripe, the most juicy, the most ready to just let go and fall into the magnificent heart of reality. The paradox of being in the world but not bound by the world. The labyrinth has a rich tradition rooted in this paradox. We enter these sacred spaces where universal being manifests itself with each of our steps, physically grounded with the weight of our bodies and the bliss of full presence. In my 20s, I came to such an intersection when my efforts became exhausted with futility, my despair became mental illness, and hope was vanquished. Somewhere along my healing journey, I was given the famous Rilke quote from a letter he had written to a young poet who was despairing over the uncertainty of his life as a writer. Rilke's quote has remained a touchstone for me for decades. I offer his words as the foundation for each unfolding conversation of the labyrinth, where there is no theme, there are no pre-written questions, and there is no particular aim for the dialogues. I'm just honored to share space in the spirit of Rilke, to live the questions now, so that perhaps without noticing, we will live along some distant day into the answer. Welcome to the labyrinth.
This is an event. This is a big event.
It's a big
event. Hang on 1 second. I just got this meeting is being recorded. Okay, we're good. Joel, I'm sorry. I just came in on the tail end of that. You said that your dad got COVID. I'm really sorry to hear that.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I just popped in there for 5 minutes just to let him know that I didn't see him today, and I've been visiting, spending long hours with him. But when he got COVID, I had to peel back because.
Okay.
But he's doing well. He's doing well. Yeah.
Thank God. Good. I'm glad. Good.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think. What are we doing here? What's going on?
You're the one that called this meeting. You're the master.
I don't even remember doing that.
The universe told you.
We are fucked.
Oh, God.
So, man. So it's just like, it just time is a funny thing, right? Because, I met Lisa in multicultural counseling class at University of Buffalo and.
Oh, yeah.
2006 or 2007.
Was that the initial meeting?
Yep.
That was ground zero.
That's a good way to put it. That was ground zero.
That's fascinating, really. Yeah.
Rich, where did you and I meet?
Oh, please. Epic events. How could I forget? We met in the perfect place, right? A philosophy class.
Perfect. Yeah. Existential philosophy class.
There you go, right? Exactly. Doesn't get any better. Get any perfect.
No. Oh, you are all holiday decked out. It looks so nice and festive.
Thank you.
And...
Do up the study.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Celebrate the pagan spirit of the occasion.
Yes. I have my Buddha. That I got in Florida. Beautiful. Remember the trip we were together?
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. Comedy. Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, Joel. What you got for us, baby?
I got not a fucking clue.
Joel, brilliant. with the synergy in this group that it would just spontaneous profundity would spontaneously emerge, right?
Or spontaneously combust.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to do something? I didn't know I was supposed to do something.
This is a happening. This is the really Zen way to have a profound conversation, I think.
Yeah.
Like, what's on everybody's mind? You guys are like, you guys seem to be sort of blossoming in the spiritual vital realm. Unlike me, wasting away here in obscurity, dying by centimeters in comparison.
Rich, so, you always say that.
I guess so. Well, I mean, the existentialism of connection, right?
A nihilist, are we?
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. A disillusioned romantic. How does that sound?
Okay. Yeah, that sounds appropriate, actually. That sounds appropriate.
And this, Rich, in this day and age, to be anything else would be delusional. You know,
good point, man. How about that? Do you guys think that that's the I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Not only personally, because right of all the events that are unfolding around in the country and around the world and everything else, but you know, I do a radio show and I have the website and I write. I'm doing another book right now, as a matter of fact. Which every time I talk to Lisa, I Carly, I tell her I'm not going to do any. You know, this is the last thing I'm writing. And every time she talks to me, I'm writing something new. I've just been wondering. I mean, you know, do you think that we're being Pollyannas, or do you think we're really living in an age and a climate of spiritual? I want to say decline. I don't know what that would malaise. Whatever.
No, you know, in terms in Buddhist cosmology, theology, philosophy, there it is always spoken in terms of there are times of dharma decay, and there's times of maybe, like, the word is maybe dharma renewal.
Yeah,
definitely in a time of dharma decay right now.
For sure. You both really sense that?
Yes.
You know, I think it's sort of, because I'm always, you know, I've always racked with self-doubt, of course. I maybe it's self-examination, maybe I'm being prudent, I don't know, but I'm always wondering, is it really me? You know, I know I'm getting, you know, we get older, you know, and stuff like that, things change, things aren't the way it was when we were younger, things really, the world changes, and sometimes I wonder, is it just me sort of not understanding and not appreciating what's going on, and the you know, the necessary you know, transformations that are going on in the world, that everybody's, you know, I remember my parents, right? And they said they were sure the world was going to hell and because of us. And then, you know, their parents said the same thing and everything else. So I just wonder sometimes, how do we know it's not us? And it's really the world.
I think when I was in India, they were also talking about the, you know, we're in the Kali Yuga right now. And so that's kind of the end of, like, a long epoch.
Yeah.
And this is sort of agreed upon, I think, by people that are far more wise than I am. You know, there is this sense of this, and I guess, you know, in the way that Joel described it, yes, it's a decline, but I think my own feeling about it is actually very optimistic. I might not see it in my lifetime. We probably won't, but I have a very strong, deep sense of this kind of the falling away is really, really critical for something much more, I think, enlightened to emerge. I feel that very strongly. And I think that as the only, you know, female on the panel, that I think as women, we're very in touch with it. Almost all of my female friends, we are deeply, deeply in touch with it. We feel it in a very profound way. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does it, when you speak about impending or coming enlightenment and enlightenment, what does that look like for you? What are you articulating in your own vision of that?
I don't have a vision of what it looks like, but I do have a vision, ironically, of what it feels like. I mean, I think within my own lifetime, as you both know, I've been through periods of, you know, kind of an ecstatic building and then kind of a falling away. So I feel like in my lifetime, and certainly Joel, I know that's been true for you too, that, you know, like we've had these big upswings and then kind of these lower times of things falling away. Yeah. And maybe because, like, I had thought, I guess, Rich, like you, that I had thought, oh, this is my own experience and I'm projecting it onto the world. But because I've had those ups and downs. However, other people, especially, like I said, women particularly, who haven't had those large, you know, ascents and descents, they're also sensing it as well. And so what does that mean? I think for what the sensing is that kind of all of the bullshit is going to start falling away. And I think we can already see that. So like I told Joel the other day, like when we were talking about, okay, what's the theme of this, that I said, you know, what's up for me right now is like relationship, the purpose of relationship, the meaning of relationship. And because I'm straddling many different kinds of relationships, I can sort of, I feel like I have my finger in a lot of different perspectives. And what I'm noticing in those realms is that there is a sense of like a real not knowing. Like everybody is just sort of like, I want something, but I don't know what it is. Where I think for our parents, or even, you know, like when I was in college, whatever, that it was like, oh, I want to get married. I want to have kids. I want to like whatever, which was not true for me. But, you know, I mean, I did sort of still have that, you know, sense of like security and monogamy and stability. And what I see, definitely, obviously living in San Francisco, and, you know, I think we're often on the cutting edge of relationships. We're often on the cutting edge of a lot of, you know, social evolutions. And one of the things that I notice is that there is a longing for connection, but not in the same way of going back the two traditional, like, I want a partner, a monogamous partner. I want the house and the kids. There's something, and to me, if you start seeing social relationships fundamentally changing, I think that's a good barometer that something bigger is happening.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, do you think that it's a, do you think social, when you say social relationships are changing in a good way?
I see it as, I think I prefer it this time to not to judge it, whether I think it's good or bad. Right. I just look at it objectively and observe what I see happening. Mm-hmm. But, and, you know, I have a 20-year-old daughter, and in her reality, it's that even for most of her friends, that paradigm doesn't exist. They're not about wanting to find the partner to get married. That's not the focus. They, especially like for Asha, I think that she feels very strongly that there is this sense of, I want my life to have meaning and purpose. And a relationship is a part of that, but I don't get my meaning and purpose through my relationship.
Yeah.
Where I think for many women, especially, we often did identify in that way, right? And I definitely see a shift in that. And that also seems to be true among her cohort as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's that the concept of, maybe it's not so much that they're not looking for relationship, but the concept or their experience of relationship is expanding in ways that it previously couldn't, in ways that, you know, right, that it previously the concept didn't encompass. So people want a relationship in a broader sense than the very narrowly prescribed ones, categories they used to be, have to fit those relationships into, and they want a deeper, more profound, more open relationship with everything, with the universe, ultimately. I mean, I don't know if many people are thinking that far, but you know, it seems to be that's what it's broadening to, at least in that direction. Right?
I think so, and I think that also, like, it's sort of a paradox, right? That like, can you have more sustaining, fulfilling relationships if you're not married, if you're not monogamous, if you're not sort of hemmed in by some sort of social structure?
Yeah.
And I think that remains to be determined. I don't have an answer for that. But what I see is that we're at the sort of precipice of that exploration. And it feels different than sort of the 60s, like anti-establishment hippies, hippie movement, because that was going against something, right? Mm-hmm. That was like, we're anti-establishment, we're anti-patriarchy, we're like, we're making a stand, we're making a political statement through our relationship status to kind of say F you to the, you know, to the man.
Yeah.
But I don't see that anymore. It seems more like we're moving towards something, even if yet we don't quite have that defined what it is, but I see the vast openness of the exploration.
Makes sense. And yet, as we were saying, there are so many forces right now that are acting against that sense.
But isn't that the way it is, though?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess you mean in the sense that the yin yang dynamic becomes more and more pronounced. What did Lao Tzu write? At the point of ultimate decay comes the turning point.
We both know my dear friend Beatrice, and you know, Beatrice and I just talked a few weeks back, and she had also said too, like, whenever the light starts to emerge, that's when kind of the forces start pushing in against it, right? And I think, and even just thinking about that, why is that, right? Why is our universe sort of set up that way? Because I think it's like testing a muscle, right? Like, okay, right? Like, okay, you've got this, and then you're pushed to how much more light can I bring? How much more goodness can I bring? How can I see? And the darkness, I think, brings out things that I didn't see. Like, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize that was, you know, there lurking. And me being a light and shedding a light on that brings that into awareness. I mean, obviously we're personifying darkness and light, but I think that there does seem to be that energy dynamic. I don't know if you guys have experienced it too, but I know for sure that, you know, I mean, I've definitely, like, that's been a felt experience of mine. So,
I mean, you're definitely so attuned to that, much more than I am, but I would like to think, I would like to feel that, and I get intimations of that, but then I'll doubt them, because then you look at, you know, it's easy to look at just take one small shift in perspective, and it just looks plain like, well, everything's just going to hell. Instead of all the, you know, oh, it's just testing a muscle, ultimately it's a necessary step to something greater. So I don't know.
And maybe that's part of my, I mean, one of the things that I know that, you know, even people that I briefly encounter, they just experience me as being very optimistic and hopeful and happy, and you know, that is, you know, maybe just a dispositional thing, that the way that I look at the world in this, and maybe that's from being a teacher, you know, I don't know, but like, you know, seeing a student that's having a pretty rough day, and rather than sort of getting at the behavior that's coming out in that moment, oh shit, the kid threw their pencil, or they, you know, ripped up their homework, or whatever it is, right? Whatever acting out, there's something underneath that. And I think I've always tried to be, not always, but, you know, more so as I've gotten older, to be more cognizant of, yes, there's the behavior, but what's going on underneath it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's the same way with this light and dark, right? That, like, yes, I feel these pressures coming in, this, like, you know, the rise of Trump. I think that's a very good example. Like, what was the immediate result of Trump getting elected? Immediately, women came out all over the world, right? I mean, that was an immediate reaction. It woke women up, right? We're like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So to me, that's, I think, a very good real world example of that happening, right? Before we were like, oh, Obama, he's great. And, you know, everything's fine. And like, we can just, you know, continue with our lives. But Trump getting elected, I think, really forced us, particularly as women, but certainly many, many, you know, people all over the world, like, oh, wait a minute. We cannot be complacent. And I think that's another part of it, is I do not see this as a time of complacency. That I feel very strongly. This is not a time of complacency. We need to be paying extreme attention to what is happening around us and really identify. By identify, I mean, to the core of our being, understand what our purpose is in it. One, to be aware of it. And two, what is my purpose in this? What awareness can I bring with my perspective? That's what I feel my work is kind of, you know, settled on now. Yeah, Joel, sorry, go ahead.
No, not at all. But Lisa, I want to, because, you know, we're having this conversation, and it's definitely intimate, and it's definitely with the three of us. But when we talk about mission and purpose, I'm just wondering, with the understanding that we're going to be offering ourselves to a wider audience, I was wondering if you could speak a little to how do we do that? How do we find our mission and purpose? How have you found where you are at now? No, I couldn't be more certain that this is, you have an expertise in this of examination. How have you arrived at whatever level you are at with your own mission and purpose? What do you attribute you having those insights and revelations and arrivals?
I think it boils down to, and both of you know me well enough to, I think, agree with this. If you disagree, please, disabuse me of my own misperceptions. I am pretty fearless, and I'm also a risk taker. And so for me, I haven't had that sense of like, oh, yes, this is it, right? I mean, I think that, like, especially going back to like when Rich and I met 30 years ago now, my gosh, that I was just at like the very nascent stages of like, there's something here. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's me, if it's something outside of me. But I think since that time, and I think, like I said, both of you, I think, can attest to this, that I've been pretty fearless in terms of going after something, even having no idea what I'm doing. And I think that a certain amount of faith in the universe, surrendering to, okay, it looks like this opportunity has presented itself, let me go and see. I think it's been through this very trial and error basis that this has happened for me. However, when I say that, I say it somewhat cautiously because I think that everybody has a different path. That's been my journey. I think other people, like I look at my daughter, she knows exactly, she's like, I've known exactly what I wanted to do since I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And wow. She has been consistently on that path. Where Aaron is also kind of in that, hey, I'm going to try this and try that and see what fits and see what works. I don't think that there's a prescribed answer. I think everyone has their own particular journey, and you have to be in alignment with the kind of person that you are. For me, doing something in a linear way that's like, oh, I'm going from point A to point B, I don't think that that would work very well for me. But for other people, I could see where that would be a beautiful way to, continue to explore. And yeah, so I mean, Joel, how about you answering that question too? Like, what's your experience of that?
Yeah, I want to answer that. I'm just wondering if we could place it before Rich real quick, and then sure. I would definitely answer it. Rich, do you have thoughts or things you want to share regarding your own exploration of mission and purpose and meaning in life?
Man, I am like, let's figure I am the last person anybody would ever want to. There's several topics, right? Ethics, personal ethics, professional ethics, work ethic, and an example for finding meaning in life. I don't know. I can't say I have a plan, that's for sure.
Well, let's start here, Rick. Let's
do the strategy. Rick, yeah.
Let's start here. Do you feel like you search or long for meaning, mission, and purpose, understanding that? Do you feel like that's a part of your curiosity?
The search for meaning?
Search for meaning, mission, and purpose, yeah.
That's the entire, that probably way too much, the entire spectrum of my concern. So yeah, yeah.
And so if we here collectively understand that maybe where we rest our curiosity and our energy and our intention.
Yeah.
Because that is the totality, the raison d'etre, the full force of what you are.
Yeah.
And that energy that you put out, what has returned to you in maybe insight and understanding regarding that?
I don't know. I don't know. Okay, I don't know if I'm any farther along.
Hold on. Let's start here. What is your academic investigations, your studies, your area of interest academically?
sort of professionally within the philosophical field of philosophy and history. I you know, the nature of consciousness, the big one, the biggest big ones, right? The nature of meaning, the nature of ultimate truth, and the nature of the universe, comparative themes in science and religion, the nature of consciousness. That's basically what the book that I'm writing about now, right now, is about. So
yeah.
And can I jump in on that, Joel?
Please.
So I think and Rich and I have talked about this, I think, for many times over the years, is that I think one of the fundamentally different approaches that you and I have to this, I think we're both looking at the same, you know, the same crystal ball, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I think that what we've sort of discovered over the years is that I used to spend a lot more time sort of immersed in the ideas of it, in the philosophy of it, in the theoretical of it.
Yeah.
And I think that somewhere along the way, I shifted into the phenomenology of it.
Yes.
Rather than asking in Rilke, right? Like, I'm living the questions.
Yeah.
I'm not really asking the questions anymore. Mm. I feel like I've shifted into away from even a questioning place, into a place of surrender, and into a place of, oh, this is coming up. And rather than sort of needing, for me, building a philosophical construct around it, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to live into this and see what arises.
Yeah.
But having said that too, I just want to reiterate kind of the previous point that I made, that all of those are necessary. We need the people to give us the theoretical frameworks. We need the people to have the lived experiences. And I think that's the multi-dimension that we're moving into, is that there isn't one right way. There isn't one, you can't just look at, let's say the environment. You cannot just look at the environment from, a chemical process,
right?
Photosynthesis. We need to see how all of these systems are interacting with other systems. How is it impacting people's lives? How is it influencing the culture of the people around them? Every single thing needs to be equally weighted and considered.
I agree. I would say this. I think that your phenomenal, your living experience of truth, of wisdom, of existence, whatever you want to call it, is, I would prioritize over mine. If I don't know, between the two of us, I don't think we have that much of a contrast. Right. And obviously, because I feel this way, I don't think that sitting in studies like this, philosophizing is the primary way to approach truth, to approach a deep understanding of existence.
Let me stop you right there, though, Rich. Let me ask you, intuitively, what do you feel is the best way to approach truth? What, intuitively, without rational thought, what do you feel in your gut is the best way to express or address truth? Just without thinking about it, just feeling into it.
Just free associating.
Yeah, yeah.
Intuitively, ecstatically, aesthetically,
yeah.
With emotionally, compassionately, yeah, yeah, passionately, those ways, and all those engaging all those things in a living engagement with the world around you and the people around you and your relationships. That is what you guys do. I really is. I mean, this is
but
why
it's also, Rich, it's also what you do. It may not be recognized within your own personal narrative within yourself.
Yeah.
Fully, it is also you.
I agree, actually. Yeah.
I give you credit. What is it that makes you guys so much more comfortable in your own skin doing it then? You seem to feel as though you've seemed to have both found a very authentic path.
I don't know. I don't know about that, but I can give you my own sort of two cents about your experience, my experience of your experience.
Who's on first?
Yeah. No, but I mean, to me, it feels like you have a very deep, you're in combat with yourself. And what is in combat with yourself is your rational construct, your rational mind, your cognition versus your intuitive self. And so you know what you know, and you don't, the rational self will not, for some reason, allow you to accept that you know what you know.
Spoken like a Zen master. I
don't know about that. I don't know about that. I think it's a heartfelt observation that, you know, it's sort of like is it the Wizard of Oz? Like, you're already home. All you have to do is wake up, right? Yeah. You're already there. You're already there. And so for you, Rich, my sense is that the only element of waking up is, you could frame it through many different paths or lenses, but fundamentally it's simply the allowance of confidence in you. It's not that you lack confidence, but you don't allow yourself to express that confidence. Usually that confidence to cross that bridge, that you don't do that, that you don't cross that bridge, is due to an insanely meticulous examination of reality and life and existence. And so until you've meticulously scrutinized everything, you will not allow yourself permission to accept you are already there. And so it reminds me, I'm at my place in Buffalo, New York, and I have a friend who's a nomad. He lives a nomadic life. He lives out of his car. He converted his car.
Tell me about that guy. Yeah.
He's out there listening to TV right now, but I invited him to join us. He wanted no part of it, but he lives out of his car, and he hiked the Appalachian Trail. He may be doing the Pacific Crest Trail. But tonight we were talking actually about someone very interesting. I don't know why it arose in me to share this with him, but I was sharing with him my fascination of the Zen teacher, Zhaozhou or Jiaxu. I don't know if either of you are familiar with Jiaxu. Jiaxu, to me, is probably in Chinese Zen or Chinese Buddhism, the pinnacle of Zen or Chan teaching. He started in a monastery at a very early age and did not start teaching, although he had received permission to through several masters as he moved through China. He did not start teaching until the ripe youthful age of 80 years old. Wow. He started in a monastery in his youth as a very young child and would not start teaching until he was 80 years old. And why do I bring this up? Well, I mean, I can see now why that arose in me, because the correlation, the parallels between you and Jiaxu, your ability to give yourself permission to teach, comes from this deep, meticulous scrutiny and scrutinizing of existence in life, whether you call it Zen or through Hinduism, consciousness itself. Like, when you cross that bridge into yourself and realize you are already there, you will realize you are right now, right where you need to be, and absolutely lacking nothing. There's nothing wrong. And you already know that, but I think you don't give yourself permission to know that.
So, this is what I love about you guys. Only people I know, every time I talk to you, it's like doing therapy. So, what, and I really mean it. So, what do I do? What did you do? Either both of you, to the extent that you have, what did you do to give yourselves permission to do this?
Can I jump in on that? Is that okay?
Yeah, please. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just sort of laughing at this in my mind at this conversation, because Rich, you were my teacher for this.
It is ironic, isn't it?
I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. There's no way. Like, you were the opener for me. And I feel like, I think when I met you, I was 22. It was literally 30 years ago now. Yeah. And I was in such a very, very different place. And when I met you, the meeting of you was so profound. I had never met anyone who I had felt was so, just had such a beautiful way of being in the world. And
it feels like curious, like you'd never met anyone who was so curious.
Yes, I think curious, but honestly, I think for me in that at that time, it was more that I saw a light in another human being that I had never seen before. And then as we got to know each other and become friends, that, I really started to see that the way that I had been looking at the world was through so many veils, and that I didn't have this full perception. And I think because that was so radical, that meeting you was so such a gestalt for me, that I think it honestly sort of set me up for a series of being ready for gestalts. Because that was such a profound life-changing moment, and it was so beautiful and positive and really, truly, truly miraculously life-changing for me, that I think I became more maybe aware of those opportunities in my life, and I didn't what do I want to say? I don't want to say that this happened overnight. It was a very gradual process of coming to recognize that that might be my path, is through these massive gestalt changes. And that has become something that I've become more and more accustomed to, more appreciative of, and more open to, I guess. Is that, again, having a sense of my path being one of surrender and being open to being surprised and being open to learning. And just to kind of like not to like I don't want to talk about in the third person as if you're not here, but I know that one of the things that you and I talked about, I think it was, maybe several years ago, was this idea that I think the shift for me was I stopped asking the why. And because I feel like it's not for me to know what the big picture is, and I'm okay with that. I think somewhere along the way I became peaceful with that. It's not for me to see the big picture. It's just for me to be as present with I can with myself as I can, to be as aware as I can about what I think my role is.
Yeah, if I could interject this real quick about that, the whole notion of sort of because I think we share that. I've actually that's a I have on a postcard someplace that very thing that don't ask why, ask how. Meaning, and it's for times of difficulty or confusion to not ask like why is this happening to me, but how do I get through this? And so, but that shift the if you never have the question of why, you will never know your how. But at a certain point, the why can drop away fully into the how.
Yes, that's been my lived experience. And also to kind of jump off of that piece too, is like I would say for me, it isn't even the how, it's the what. What am and I turn that back on myself. What is being asked of me? What do I need to learn about the situation? What do I need to perceive in this situation?
Wow. All right. I mean, it seems as though that and that isn't scary for you guys because once you let go of the why and you just allow yourself that collapse into the how or the what, whatever you want to call it, you're saying, okay, there is no ultimate. You're suspended over a bottomless chasm, right? You'll never know.
Kierkegaard's leap of faith.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I'll tell you, this is interesting, and I was wondering if we would go here, but I will tell you, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this, Lisa. I can edit this out if you'd like.
No, of course.
One element that Lisa and I share is that we've let go to a place where we let go of our mental, and it's not mental. It's we let go of holding it together. We fell apart.
Yes.
Essentially, we fell
Yes.
apart.
Yes.
I can tell you
Wow.
distinctly. For me, and I know because I know Lisa, for Lisa, arriving at the comfortableness of just the existential, the comfort with the existential dilemma is directly tied to falling apart and seeing that even if we fall apart, not only do we reassemble at a higher level, it actually allows that to happen. So that when we hold it together, we're constricting ourselves in a way that doesn't allow an evolving in a way quite as rapid as, you know, yeah, well, hospitalization, sure. You know, nonsensical states of mind and being, yeah, I've had that. And yet, here I am. So, I mean, you know, people can look at that in many different ways, and I understand most or all of them, but for my own personal narrative, Lisa talked about courage, and I think I don't know that I had the choice. I don't think I was granted a choice.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
I do think it was grace that carried me through those.
Me too.
Those elements.
100%.
Yeah, but I do think that the confidence that Lisa and I have that you notice, Rich, may be tied to the rational. The cognitive and even emotional cognitive holding it together, because we don't know what the alternative. It's, you know, I'll offer this to Lisa. You know, what does the phoenix or the dragon do? What does it represent, right, Lisa? I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh my gosh! I mean, the phoenix, of course. I have a tattoo of a phoenix, and for me, that. I mean, Rich, I gave you an earring, right? Do you remember? I gave you an earring of a phoenix.
Yes.
It has been a very powerful symbol for me because I, you know, I'm very open about, you know, my mental health history and, you know, I attempted suicide and in after that sort of very slow coming back from that, I made a commitment to myself that I would never do that again, that no matter the falling apart, no matter the experience for me, and I'm not making a judgment for other people, the decisions that they make for themselves and for their own life journey. But for me, I knew that I didn't need to do that in this lifetime. That was not my agreement. That wasn't the pact. And so that phoenix tattoo that I got is literally a reminder on my flesh that I will rise again. And that no matter what I'm going through, no matter like if I leap off of the, you know, into the abyss and I land splat, I'm going to, whatever is there is going to reconsolidate itself. And it will, I think, Joel, you just so beautifully put it that, you know, once that, it's almost like the, you know, they talk about like the broken heart, right? When your heart breaks open, it's like it expands it and makes room for more. And I feel like that's happened over and over and over again, a multitude of times in my life. But even more so, what I've noticed of late is that the first couple times of surrender were enormous, were just incredible and fraught with a great deal of anxiety and pain and fear. And I mean, it's almost indescribable. I think if you haven't allowed yourself to be in that place of surrender, you might not have a sense of what that, you know, sort of like we talked about phenomenologically feels like. Joel.
Just quickly, what you're describing, and maybe you could speak a little bit more about it, is the existential abyss. So could you speak a little bit about that? Yeah. Because I think that it's that thing that is holding Rich to hold himself together, the fear of the existential abyss, the you know, the unknowable quality of what we are and where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What do, and so again, if I was asking Kierkegaard or Nietzsche or Heidegger, what would they be telling me then? More importantly, you guys. So it sounds, everything you're saying to me speaks, you know, volumes. I get why, how having, being able to face the abyss of confronting, you know, those deepest aspects of who we are requires tremendous courage. It sounds as though it requires tremendous strength. I don't know if I could do what you guys did.
So I want to add a qualification to this, and I think Joel will agree with me, but you know, if there's a difference here, Joel, please. So I had this realization, I think it was probably 3 years ago, that I've always marveled at Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, Rosa Parks. Joel, I think I shared this with you too, that like, you know, I've always admired these people and how do they do this and what courage they have. And wow, this is incredible. But I had this epiphany, literally it was this epiphany, this awakening moment of it's not courage at all. It is them being in total alignment with who they are and they have no choice. Mm. So for me, there isn't a sense of, oh my gosh, this takes courage to do this. Mm. Rich, when I tell you I don't have a choice, I'm telling you I don't have a choice. Mm. I don't feel like I have, let me take that back slightly. I have a choice, but the alternative is so out of alignment with who I am now that would take more effort and energy to have to construct myself into something that is societally acceptable or that is agreeable or makes everybody feel comfortable. That would feel more deadening to me than to look at that abyss and say, there is the universe. And I know in the deepest recesses of my being, I know that this is a benevolent universe. And I know that when I take a step off into that abyss, that the universe is right there for me. But if I step into the world of culture and people and institutions and all of that, that is going to be something that's going to be very deadening to me. Yeah. So that's, I guess I would just distinguish about, for me, it doesn't feel courageous at all. Because it feels very in alignment with who I am. And at the point now, it would feel so inauthentic for me to not be that. Mm. That would almost require more effort and strength to be in that world than it would be to be kind of standing on the precipice now. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that's what both of you are saying, that being true to yourself in the deepest possible sense, in a way, is the easiest thing in the world. It's the
absolutely easiest thing in the world. Absolutely. And I think I learned, and I think I learned that from, you know, studying Gandhi and studying Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, really like trying to understand, because I was coming at it from the same perspective that, wow, what courage they had, but they didn't experience it that way at all. We're looking at it from the outside because they were, and not only that, but Martin Luther, it's very, I mean, if you look at their last speeches and their last teachings, they knew the end was coming.
Yeah.
They knew it was coming. They prophesied in their own way. They knew the end was coming and there was not an ounce of fear in them because they knew that they were in alignment with their being. They knew that they were here to do what they were meant to do. And the length of time, any of those other factors, they become absolutely meaningless in the bigger scheme of things. And that was a huge epiphany for me, a huge awakening for me.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. I mean, that sounds a lot like enlightenment. But so how do you get that? How does that come? Where does that epiphany come from? It doesn't sound like something that you make happen, that you can sort of follow a program, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like Joel was saying, I mean, right, Joel? I mean, you're saying you almost don't have a choice. It sounds like you guys are saying it forces itself on you almost, no?
Well, I'll tell you that for me, that two things. Okay, I've had, you know, I mean, I would count maybe three or four that I think were life changing, like life altering epiphanies that I've had. And every single one of them has come at a time of extreme despair, extreme despair. And I think that that's sort of what, you know, Kierkegaard also talks about that, right? The multitude of despair. And that you can have the despair of just giving up and quitting, or you have the despair of possibility, right? Which is a paradox. But I think that, like, so I had this experience actually in Florida, the trip that I went to meet you, Rich, that we met, you know, by happenstance. And I was sitting on the beach and had been really, like, just not in a great place. Like, I was going through a lot of things with my parents at the time and feeling really abandoned and rejected and, you know, all of those kind of core notions about myself were falling away and were both falling away and being reinforced at the same time. Like, they were happening at the same, my biggest fears, all of my triggers, everything was up. Okay, so I'm sitting on the beach in Daytona and I'm, you know, the sun is setting and I literally have nowhere to stay because I happen to be there during biker week, which we know is notoriously impossible to find anywhere to stay. And I'm sitting on the beach thinking, oh my God, like I don't know where to go. I literally am sitting on the beach and I have nowhere to go. So I sat there all day long. And I'm sitting on the beach and the sun is setting and I see, it's the simplest thing in the world. I see this pelican come by, swoop down, get a fish, like the whole scene, right? And I was like, my God, that is fucking beautiful, right? And was just moved to the core and then started looking at the sunset and started looking at the waves. And I was like, my God, this world is perfect. Literally, that's the word that came to mind. This world is perfect. And then as soon as that thought came into my mind, I was like, I am a part of this world. Mm-hmm. I am a part of this creation. Mm-hmm. I am perfect exactly as I am right now in this moment. And that was, this was in 2017, I think, 27. Was it 2017, Rich? 2017, 2018, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was, that was a huge epiphany for me. Mm-hmm. Like, for me to be constantly, like, judging myself, feeling my incompetencies, looking at all the faults that I have and the triggers that I have in this fragile way that I move through the world. I was like, that pelican's not thinking that. That wave isn't thinking that. It's perfect exactly as it is. And I am perfect and I am exactly where I need to be. And it was from that, right after that happened, is when I was like, I need to find somewhere to stay, went on Airbnb for the first time in my life and found Dominique, where she gave me this beautiful painting of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And that has happened over and over and over again. So when I'm pushed up against the wall in those feelings of deep despair and deep self-doubt, that is when the breaking open has repeatedly happened. And sometimes that period of being pushed up against the wall or being in the darkness of the falling into the abyss, like the feeling of falling, sometimes it's been more sustained. You know, it's been for months. It's been for long periods of time. But every single time, and I guess just because experientially this has happened, every single time, man, when I come back with something from the gods. It's like I come back with fire. I come back with diamonds. I come back with pearls every single time. And I wouldn't give up any of those experiences that I've had that have been utterly terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I would not give up any of those experiences for anything, because those things that I've gained in that journey are priceless and no one can take them away from me because they have now been woven into who I am.
That's incredible. That's really incredible. And the same with you, Joel. I mean, not the same. Did your life insights, if that's, it almost sounds trivial to put it that way, but did your intimations of truth come through those same kinds of periods of adversity. That's also a bad way to put it. You know what I'm saying? Did you have a similar experience?
Yeah, I think that when I think in terms of like the expanse of time, and I think in terms of like how we look at like justice or the metering out of justice and beyond justice, mercy, love and compassion, and the binding of karmas of individuals, I think of us, the three of us here, I think of like, what are the karmic links, or they're not even links. It's a bound, a binding, a
bind. I was going to say bound. Yeah.
But you know, Lisa and I share different, some similarities and some differences, but certainly the three of us share a deep curiosity. How that curiosity manifests in our phenomenology, our intrinsic emotional and cognitive and spiritual life, very, very, as we are each different signatures of the universe. But, you know, certainly Lisa and I, through our just the utter absurdity of some of the situations that we've been in, have been forced to ask, what the fuck? Mm. So deeply.
Amen to that, yes.
We've asked the question, what the fuck, so deeply.
Yes.
Something cracked open in us.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, and part of that asking that question, what the fuck, sometimes leads to destabilization, because
Yes. Why
you're asking the question, what the fuck, is because something so fucking untoward happened that needs to be processed, addressed, assimilated, and ingrained in a kind of understanding and then wisdom to give to others. That when we talk about, you asked me much earlier on, Lisa, you asked me about meaning, purpose, and mission. And so when I look at these, so in another language, Rich, when I look at the traumas that I've had in early childhood and adolescence, that have taken me till probably last year to extract the full content of what I was required, or as Lisa says, which I'm in full accordance with, contracted to do, that I'm contracted to do certain things in this incarnation before I incarnated. I agreed yes. to complete certain things. And so as I deconstruct the insanity of certain events into questioning, looking at them, and in seeing them lose my mind because there was no sense to them.
Yes.
Then holding space for them to assemble my relationship with them. What is this to me? Then I begin to find myself in a very deep way.
Yes.
And then I can ask the very deep personal questions with sensitivity. What does this mean for my experience, my soul's journey through this incarnation? You can ask why in that context. Why did this happen to me? And if you ask why in that context enough, and you extract the why was I raped? Why did I have these profound experiences of abuse? And you ask why, and it reveals itself to you. And then you kind of merge why this has happened and what you have learned into a wisdom far greater than anything that eventually gets offered to the community, which is what I feel at a place I hopefully am arriving at now, that, you know, the experiences that I have now, I'm able to reach people who have in varying degrees and measures experienced after I did what I have experienced, but I have a key, I have language, a code that I can break and translate and offer them a bridge to the home within themselves that never changes, but is not always recognized by oneself.
And you both feel at home in the world now, to use a Heideggerian phrase, or no?
No.
You're shaking your head. That's interesting.
No.
Wow. Why? That's interesting. Why the difference? And so why? Just why,
well,
I guess.
Some of this is language. So, I mean, some of this is just straight up language. But, you know, my understanding is one of the most profound experiences that I had was such a minor, it was like a blip, a moment of insight into things that I understood something where everything is in flux, shifting around me, and yet it's against a backdrop of how do you even describe this backdrop that we are in, that we are, it is all pervading, it is everywhere, there is no place that it does not exist. Mm-hmm. In the Snow Leopard, Lama Govinda says, it is close to us, but we are far from it.
Yes.
And so that all-pervading nature of reality, Buddha mind, or the Christ nature, or, you know, Brahman, you know, it just, I can't tell you how, not just that this all makes sense, like how can that be, but it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Not only does it make sense, when you begin to pull away the bigger veils, the bigger picture, the bigger expanse, you see a love expressed by, for us, what seems like a roll of the dice,
yes,
but is the complete opposite of that.
Agreed.
So, and what I mean by that is that it's like we are the die that are cast, but it is known what number will pop up.
Yes.
We don't know that until we have the experience through time in the incarnation after incarnation, lesson after lesson, who, what, when, where, and why we will do what we will do. We won't know that. It is known, but not by us. So how do we know it? The universe gives us these experiences to know ourselves.
Yes.
In relation to others as well as ourselves and it, you know, the author of this, I refer to what some call God is actually, you know, in many ways with my own kind of sense of like wanting justice, I think of God as the great accountant. You know, I can just burn all notions of worrying about whether this, that, or the other comes back to anyone. There's a great accountant that takes care of all that for me, you know, that I'm actually employed by, but, you know, and that, you know, but the secret here, Rich, is so are you and so is Lisa. You know what I mean? Like, there isn't anything here that isn't employed by it, but it, you know, it's just the veils hide that from us. And, you know, there's a Yiddish phrase that God is a fair boss, but he's slow to pay the wage. So, you know, we sow our seeds of mitzvot and goodness and service, but it doesn't come back to us at our own time. It comes back to us when the universe sees and deems it so.
Yeah. Yiddish wisdom, I'm telling you.
Nothing
like it.
Yeah.
So I think why I said no, I don't feel at home in the world. One, I think we all love Rumi here, and I deeply resonate with the quote, we're all walking each other home. This mm-hmm. does not feel like home to me. This feels like a part of the journey. But it definitely doesn't feel like the end point. Mm. And for me, home is that place where I am in perfect alignment with the universe, with my highest self. That's where home is. Yeah. And so that's why I say I don't feel at home, because I haven't manifested that yet within myself.
Yeah.
How about you?
What do you think, Ken?
Not up to me to speak for you, my dear.
I guess so. I guess I well, you know, and I it depends on the day you ask me and the
so way how about right now, right here, right now,
right here, right now. I sense. Well, I mean, again, I'm operating at a much higher spiritual dimension when I'm in the presence of you. Well, literally, I mean, honestly, I'm attuned to much more when I'm in the presence of you guys. But I think in my heart of hearts, all the time, I tend to feel like a lost soul. But at the same time, and again, this is why I feel such a close kinship to you, and we always have. I sense ultimately it's just that I have, as Joel has intimated, just not. I don't know what it's going to take, but I just reminds me of a Hindu. There's a Hindu, a few interesting, fun Hindu stories about from the scriptures. Right, there's a prince who gets hit on the head. And he's wandering around his kingdom as a pauper, doesn't know where he lives, and he's looking for home and everything. And he doesn't realize he owns the whole thing, right? And there's a sense in which or a guy who's sleeping next to the person he loves, and he's in his dreams, he's searching for his love all over the world, not realizing he's sleeping right there in her arms the whole time. And I really sense, I guess, in my heart of heart of heart of hearts, if I could just wake up somehow. I could sense that and see that. And that's why I think what you guys say resonates so deeply with me. And when we're doing therapy, I mean, we're doing this informal therapy and you're saying this to me, I get what you're saying. And it's kind of bizarre. So I'm saying I need to feel this way and I know it. And here I am. So I don't know. What do I do?
So here's something we don't have to do it now, but just something to think about in the future, that when you have that thought, when you have those feelings of, am I just wandering in my own kingdom, right? Yeah. Like, sink into your body. Where is that living? Get out of your head, get out of the pictures of it, get out of the images of it, and really just like stop the thoughts. Mm-hmm. And when I have this, where in my body is this living? Drop down. And I think that when you're able to do that, and this is true, you know, hopefully for anybody who's listening, that sometimes when we get caught up in these thoughts that repeat themselves over and over and over again, that if we can locate them within our body, that can be very helpful and instructive about where some of those resistances are. Perhaps there's an unknown, like by unknown, I mean that we're not aware of a trauma that either happened in this life or that we've carried in from a previous life that might be sort of imprisoning that feeling of freedom within our body in that place. But, you know, I used to really, and, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Joel and I used to joke about this all the time, that I am so cerebral, right? Remember, Joel? His eyes are like popped out of his head. We talk about it all the time. And Joel was so good about it. He's like, okay, Lisa, get out of your head. Lisa, okay, that's great. Lisa, get out of your head. Mm-hmm. And I feel like one of the things that I've always, you know, it's an interesting thing, Rich, because I know that you say this, and I know that you've said this repeatedly for, you know, almost the 30 years that we've known each other, but it's very interesting that maybe you're the person wandering the kingdom that he doesn't know that he's, you know, the king of, but I will tell you that in that wandering, whatever you touched in me, that was the thing that helped me to see myself and for me to see my own reality and the reality of something far more expansive and beautiful. And maybe, just maybe, that is your gift. Maybe that is the gift, that you are there as a teacher. It's no surprise you're a teacher, that It's the way that you touch other people. And you might be the blind prophet, right? That you are awakening so many people around you, while you yourself might perceive or feel that you aren't, or that you don't perceive, you know, you haven't perceived that within yourself, but something is moving through you in such a beautiful and profound way that so many hundreds and hundreds of lives of people that you've come into contact with, that you have touched in this way and awoken them. And perhaps that is the gift. So I think that's another way to think about this is, any idea about what I had about what my gift has, I can assure you has been completely disabused by the universe. Completely. And that's been a big thing about ego, right? Like, oh, I know what my path is, and oh, I know what I'm supposed to do, and even this idea of I'm in this co-creative space with the universe and the universe has asked me to do this. Oh, no. It changes all the time. It changes all the time. This space that I've just moved into of, you know, providing company for corporate executives, like I would have never thought in my wildest dreams that that would be anything that I would do. Mm. And it is every time that I'm there, I know that is exactly where I need to be. Mm. And so just, I think, being responsive. Yeah. Being responsive to the universe, and this is sort of coming in, and does this feel in alignment with what I need to be doing right now? Let's give it a try and see. And if this is bringing light and goodness and joy and anything of positivity to the people that I am in touching in their lives, then yes, that's where I'm supposed to be. And maybe it doesn't look like me being a teacher. Maybe it doesn't look like me being a writer. Maybe it doesn't look like it doesn't. That is me having an ego, is by putting a boundary around it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just responding to, it's like a chemical reaction, right? Like it's a catalyst, and I need to be ready to be catalyzed. I think that's a good way to say it. Mm. I need to be ready to be catalyzed.
Yeah.
And I feel that my life experiences have led, this is sort of coming in, and does this feel in alignment with what I need to be doing right now? Let's give it a try and see. And if this is bringing light and goodness and joy and anything of positivity to the people that I am in touching in their lives, then yes, that's where I'm supposed to be. And maybe it doesn't look like me being a teacher. Maybe it doesn't look like me being a writer. Maybe it doesn't look like it doesn't. That is me having an ego, is by putting a boundary around it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just responding to, it's like a chemical reaction, right? Like it's a catalyst, and I need to be ready to be catalyzed. I think that's a good way to say it. Mm. I need to be ready to be catalyzed.
Yeah.
And I feel that my life experiences have led me to a place where I do feel that, like, I feel like I'm okay being in a place of surrender enough that I can be catalyzed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you guys remind me of my students in Daytona, the college here. They have a great surfing team, like one of the best, you know.
So
you
yeah. Can,
right? And yes. You guys are one of the surfers. The way they describe the experience
yes.
and when they're surfing. They're always yes. arriving, and yet they're yes. never there. So it's...
Yes.
Is that accurate? I don't know.
100%. Also, I mean, living in San Francisco, right? Like, I know a lot of surfers that's so, I've used that metaphor before too.
Really?
And man, the minute you hold rigid to that board, you are down for the count. Mm-hmm. You've got to be light, and you've got to move with how the board is moving and move with how the waves are moving. And the minute you become rigid or try to predict, That's when you fall off your board.
Yeah.
I guess that's how I've learned after, like Joel was saying, getting knocked on my ass time and time and time again, and getting pulled under that riptide, and you know, and being pulled to the bottom and not knowing if I was going to come back up. that I learned, man, surrendering is a hell of a lot easier. It's scary, but I'll tell you, it's a hell of a lot easier.
And you, yeah. And I guess, so I, you really, so then in that sense, maybe Joel, because you're a pretty active meditator still, right, Joel? Because it sounds like what you're describing, Lisa, is living.
I'm not at all.
No, I know, but it sounds like what you're describing is living meditation in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I have a couple things that I want to offer up. One, Rich, is something that allowed me to be more comfortable existentially was actually a rabbinical teaching. And it's actually a very beautiful story. And I don't know if it's from the Talmud. I think it may be from the Talmud, but I'm really not sure. But it's about Reb Zusha. Reb Zusha was a student of a great Rav, a great rabbi, and he had his own following. He was, you know, known to be very, very poor, didn't have a lot of money, and saw everything as kind of like a blessing. But, you know, with his students, I think he had quite a few very profound students become great masters in their own right. And when it was time for Reb Zusha to depart from this world, you know, the students gathered around him on his sort of like his deathbed, and they were all talking and discussing with him different things. And it arose that one of the students asked him, they said, Reb Zusha, you know, what are you scared of? Like, you know, your time is coming and time to depart from this world and go to the next. And in Judaism and Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism and in Jewish teachings, when you pass, you go to a heavenly court. So the balance of your deeds are determined by a heavenly court. The interesting spin on that is the Baal Shem Tov taught that that what happens is actually the judge of that. We don't know who the judge is, because the soul that judges has actually been disembodied from the memory of the incarnation itself. So if you follow what I'm saying, you yourself judge your own life without memory that it was your life that you were living. So ultimately you yourself are your own judge and your own jury. And so the teaching out of that is always in Judaism to judge everybody favorably, because one day it'll be you yourself judging yourself. Mm-hmm. But to get back to Reb Zusha, Reb Zusha thought about the question that his student had about what he would fear when he died. And Reb Zusha thought long and hard, and it came to him. He said, you know, if I get to the heavenly court and the heavenly voice cries out, why weren't you like Abraham? Reb Zusha said, I won't be afraid. And Reb Zusha said, if the heavenly voice cries out, why weren't you like Moses? Reb Zusha said, I will not be afraid. Reb Zusha said, the only thing that scares me is that if the heavenly voice cries out, why weren't you Reb Zusha? I'll be very, very afraid. Yeah. And so, you know, I take that as a teaching that, you know, there's this notion that we have in the human incarnation, because we are socialized and social beings, that there are ideas of perfectionism and ideals to attain that are messages given to us, which help us along our mission and path, but it can also be impediments to us being our true self, as Lisa has talked about. And so I really think that letting go that Lisa and I did, and to the degrees to which we did, which led to our hospitalizations and destabilization in our mental health conditions, that we reassembled ourselves, but we reassembled ourselves with veils penetrated. Certain veils were penetrated that are placed in this human incarnation. And one of the things that I was thinking about with you, Rich, is that you may not even realize how the universe utilizes you. It is veiled from you. And let me assure you this, this is just my own take on it, but it is with good reason. But it is not that that veil cannot be penetrated. So that both are true, that you may not understand, as Lisa's is offered in testimony and Veritas, her experiences of your profound impact. And let me assure you, Rich, you know, a bat strikes a ball. You know, it's not like gas, liquid, solid. You're not looking at like a gas striking a solid or whatever, liquid. Like you struck her in that way because there's something in you that is that way.
Yes.
And so I wanted to point that out and reflect that back to you. And I also wanted to say that, you know, very, very pointedly, you know, I came across this passage from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. You know, there are two, they're essentially, in my understanding of American Zen, the transmission of from India to China to Japan to America, two of the foundational texts or books on American Zen are, one is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shunryu Suzuki's informal talks on Zen. Teisho is essentially, Teisho is a Zen sermon. I guess you could describe it as like a Zen sermon. So it's his informal talks on Zen. And the other is The Three Pillars of Zen, which is Roshi Philip Kaplu, who actually I met a realtor who met Roshi Kaplu in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And he told me a very interesting story that I did not know. It was actually Roshi Philip Kaplan, and his father is Jewish, as my father is Jewish. And so that was just an interesting little anecdote that they had met directly. And Roshi Kaplu had shared that with this person. But the thing that I want to share with you now, Rich, is and Lisa, is it's from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and it's transiency. So it says, we should find perfect existence through imperfect existence. The basic teaching of Buddhism is the teaching of transiency, or change. That everything changes is the basic truth for each existence. No one can deny this truth, and all the teachings of Buddhism are condensed within it. This is the teaching for all of us. Wherever we go, this teaching is true. This teaching is also understood as the teaching of selflessness, or emptiness, shunyata. Your and Lisa and mine, our original face, our original self. It is the very backdrop which all physical reality takes place. It doesn't change in us. It always has been and forever will be, cannot be destroyed. Because each existence is in constant change, there is no abiding self. In fact, the self nature of each existence is nothing but change itself, the self nature of all existence. There is no special separate self nature for each existence. You and I and Lisa are all the same thing. And that's also the backdrop of karma. So, and I think I wanted to share this with you because I wanted to point to this fundamental point for me when we talk about meaning, mission, and purpose. For me, fundamentally, it is summed up in only one word. If you want to know your meaning, your mission, and your purpose, the totality of it is summed up in one word. And it is through the veracity and the ferociousness and the dedication to this one word will determine the quality of your understanding of your meaning, mission, and purpose. And that word is service.
Service.
How deeply you serve, how deeply you serve others, because we are all the same self. You're only eventually through karmic return of what you offer, we reach a point. We are the center of the universe itself. It has been given to us by the universe to be the center point of the universe itself, to build the world we wish to inhabit through how we move through this incarnation and every incarnation, with the notion that all we give in intention, thought, action, and speech returns to us like in kind, beauty to beauty, hatred to hatred. And so because we are all the same self, what I give to Lisa and what I give to you is what I receive. And the quality of our experience, Rich and Lisa, the quality of our experience is not what we receive from others, it's what we give to others.
You guys are freaking great. I really mean it. I love you guys. I mean, both of what you have imparted to me is so, I know, I mean, I don't know. I'm still on a long journey, but I feel like I'm closer to some essential aspect of it.
So one of the other things that you and I have talked about too, is that, one of the reasons why it's really challenging for you and I to connect, or for, you know, you and Joel to connect, is because of the enormous love and care that you have for the people in your life. And we've talked about that. That is a profound act of love and service. And like I said, it's not necessarily what you think the journey is going to be. It is what you are called to do. And that is what you are being called to do in this life and at this time in this life. Mm-hmm. And that itself is the act of service. And that is the gift, not only that you are giving in the act of service, but the universe has provided that for you as a gift, because it is an opportunity for you as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more about a shifting in perspective than anything else. It's not that you're not there, whatever there is. I don't think there's a there. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a recognition that the universe has given you these opportunities. How do you respond to it? And you respond to those situations with the grace of a Zen master, without question. And that is so profound and beautiful and enlightened. And it is exactly the way you touched me. It is exactly the way you touched me. And that is your gift of being able to see, whether it's a physical brokenness or an emotional brokenness, you touched me in a way that fundamentally healed on a deep karmic level, fundamentally healed me. That is beyond anything of whether you have an awareness of it or not.
You know, it's funny because on my way, today I had a good friend come from out of town, and we went to visit his father who lives here in Lockport, and he brought his son, and we were talking about, you know, things. And I said, oh, I'm doing a podcast tonight with my friends, Bruce and Lisa. And I told my friend Bruce about you, Rich. And I said how you elicit through your own humility, through almost through the very uncertainty that you have in you, you are able to, I'm not saying, you know, I want to phrase this the right way, but like you elicit such wonderful things in others in response to that. And it's almost like a teaching quality or characteristic that you allow others to ascend so that you can watch them fly. Yeah. And that's out of that is like a very, you know, there's an inherent, deep, intrinsic, and undeniable humility in that.
Humbleness, exactly. Yep, 100%.
The humility is, you know, I feel so understood and heard by you, and I feel like your curiosity is so genuine, and your questioning is so genuine, and the dialogue. You did this also, Rich, both when we shared the solo podcast that we did, but also in the panel, you would ask these questions in ways that, you know, people would just, you bring the best out in people in ways that are so self-effacing, and you may not, you know, you're not in another's experience, but I can tell you and reflect it back to you that it's a very special sensitivity, you know. Yeah.
Thanks, guys. I mean, really, yeah. I feel much better about myself right now.
I have to put in the chat here, Rich, where to send the check. So,
seriously, it's kind of an ineffable understanding we have, and I know you guys know how much what you say and what you teach means to me. So I can't tell you what that means to me. That's a tremendous, tremendous affirmation. One thing I really did want to ask you guys, and almost seems trivial now. I'm just
curious. Before you do that, before you jump out of that and jump into that trivial, I'm gonna just push one more thing.
Okay.
When you heard us talking about you that way, how did you feel? What were the feelings that came up around that? Like, not the thoughts like, oh, I agree or I disagree, or like, literally what was happening for you in your body?
In my body, that's interesting. An affirming warmth. Is that okay? Is that do it?
No right or wrong. It's just, again, kind of like, you know, I think that is, because what I have known about you in the past is there's a lot of resistance to that. And so I think that that's why I'm asking that question. And I'm glad that you're feeling in that place of acceptance and warmth and affirmation of it. I think that alone is quite a profound shift from places that you've been in the past, where you hear that and then you know, either deflect it or you know, become very uncomfortable with it. And that's something that I've had to learn as well. And a recent friend that I've made said to me, it was actually very funny. She was like, she's also a very fierce goddess woman. And she was like, bitch, you are a goddess and you own your fucking queenness. And huge. And I just heard it. And she was like, don't you hold back. Like, she's like, you just embrace that and feel that and be that, because that has nothing to do with me. That is the thing that was given to me, right? This isn't something I've created. This is a gift that was given to me. And if I reject it, or if I make myself feel small in the face of it, then I'm actually saying a big fuck you to the universe, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess I just wanted to sort of check in with you around that and see, like, are you having some more openness and ability to receive that kind of, you know, affirmation? Because, yeah, Joel and I are privileged to be in this position to tell you this. But I can promise you there are probably 1,000 other people in the world, Rich, that would kill to have this opportunity to tell you exactly the same thing that we're telling you, because that is how you move through the world. And you are a gift to us. I know you are a gift to me. You've changed not this life. You've changed my existence, my being. And I know that you've had a profound impact on Joel. We've talked about it. Absolutely. So anyway, I just wanted to stop and pause there for a second and just kind of, like, you know.
No, thanks. That puts a capstone on it. I really appreciate it. And it sounds trivial to say ditto to you guys. I hope it's obvious. I really do. I hope it's obvious to you guys, how much it means to me, just this experience alone. And having you, again, I don't know how much you guys charge, if you charge by the hour for this kind of spiritual therapy, but
are you a CEO?
unfortunately, I know. I just I can't pay your rates, unfortunately. I would love to talk about me for hours more, but I really am curious to know from you guys, and this is about me. Maybe that's why, if I do evoke these things in other people, but through my questioning and my humble mode of inquiry, it's because I am just genuinely seeking. When I find somebody with wisdom, I'm just all over it. I'm dying and I need that. And I'm wondering with you guys, and again, it really does almost seem trivial because of all the things you've talked about the nature of your connection to the universe, because it seems so much wider than this. But how has this made you come to terms with the idea of just biological death, with the fact that you're, you know, with mortality in that sense? How do you feel? I mean, you know, you obviously feel.
Yeah. Do you mind if I
go ahead?
Yeah. Do you mind if I answer this first for myself, please?
Are you asking me?
Yeah. Do you mind if I answer it real quick?
Oh my gosh, please, Joel. No, of course.
So it's really, I mean, I think that there, you know, It's the very nature of our human life is a paradox, because we cannot exist without connection and relationship and comfort and love. And yet we are asked again and again to relinquish these things lifetime after lifetime. And so people can say, yeah, I don't fear death, or, you know, I'm pretty brave, or, you know, you can say that there are all different kinds of different relationships and comforts with impermanence. But, you know, I was just mentioning to you before, my father has COVID. He just had a hip surgery. He's 91.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all my spiritual cultivations and evolutions, like, I can't bear to see him go. I just can't. I can't. There's no language. There's no measure of readiness that really prepares me for that, other than the experience itself. And so, you know, people may say how fearless they are or how brave they are, but really, for me, I feel in this conversation to articulate the need that I'm very vulnerable, very, very susceptible to the suffering and grief of loss and pain and death. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it hasn't, it's not like something you've overcome because of the insights you've garnered from the universe.
Well, I mean, my backdrop, my understanding of it is that, I mean, to speak about this in very genuine terms, is that my father and I have a very deep, ancient past life affinity and connection. There are reasons that make sense that we have evolved and through time to this time and place. And yet, I just, you know, there are things that Rumi says, do not grieve. Anything you lose comes around in another form. And so you're tested in that regard with death. That
Rich and I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
Or you and I, Joel.
Yeah.
We don't know anything about that.
Yeah. I don't know. I understand that what I let go of is actually memory and attachment of this time and place. But I don't need to let go. Love always finds love again. Like when the bond is deep enough, the karma returns in future incarnations, and the cognition and memory may not be there from the previous incarnation. But oftentimes consciousness itself does a strange thing where time may slow when you reconnect with an ancient past life connection. It's happened to me before on a couple of occasions. And, you know, I'm fascinated by that because, you know, really, if you examine, there's a great sensitivity for our experiences that aren't cognitive and aren't even embodied about this incarnation, but a soul connection, reconnecting after, you know, loving and relinquishing or releasing that love and connection and finding it again. There's something so exquisite in the not knowing that I have known this person before. I mean, there's something beautiful about that. Yet when I place that in context or lens through my father, I just cannot bear, you know, it's been such a beacon of a lighthouse for me in this incarnation of how to return to convention, how to return to things that most people value and cherish, where I was very disoriented and very not even knowing how to prioritize or look for those things because I had so much trauma that I couldn't understand why people would value certain conventional markers like job, family, marriage, and stuff like that. I just didn't even have the room, the space for it in my phenomenology, in my kind of prioritizing life. I just was trying to get through my trauma, you know, and he was really he was a beacon, a lighthouse. And the funny thing about it is that he has no idea for you, Rich, I say this, but he has no idea why, what, where, when, and how he has been beyond so important to me. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, you know, we've been going at this for about an hour and 40 minutes. And I'm just wondering, I really just want to put Lisa on the spot and see, do you have a poem for us, Lisa?
Do I have a poem?
What do you got, Lisa Carly? What do you got?
Oh my goodness.
What comes to mind?
I don't have any poetry.
Yeah, what comes to mind in the moment?
I never have poetry. Let's see. Should I read the one that you liked, Joel?
You should do whatever the fuck you want, Lisa.
Really? You're giving me permission? Finally? After
yeah, yeah.
What a guy.
I know. I know.
Very generous like that. Where's the mics, man?
The Mike's Hard Lemonade?
Yeah.
Coming. It's coming.
All right.
Rich, that's a reference. We did a podcast in 2013 in Lisa's Hyundai Elantra in a gas station parking lot.
I listened to that.
Delaware.
Yeah.
We had American Spirits and Mike's Hard Lemonade. And I think we had Rumi. We had Roshi Philip Kaplu's Zen Teaching, Zen Practice.
Yep.
Some Pringles. What else?
And it was a 3 hour long thing, and man, by the end of it, we were wasted. It got more and more hilarious as time went on. It was a blast. It was just awesome. Yeah.
I heard
Next
that.
Next time we should do it with edibles.
Yeah. The floating podcast.
Yeah. Big podcast. I love it. I love it. All right. So poem. All right, I'm going to read this one because you liked it the other day, Joel, okay?
Okay.
All right. So this has been a recurring theme in my life. And so this poem is, I think, captures that sense of longing and the finding the balance between like what I want and what the universe wants of me, and me trying to extract from other people what I want from them. and the frustration that I come up against when I do that. And this, I think, is a reminder to just like let all that go. But And I just want to share that this poem came out of, so I have a very dear friend in India, Onkar Mishra, and he and I started a thing where we would make a commitment to write a poem to each other once a week. Oh, and wow. It's not that it's about him or about us. It was just, we just pushed each other and inspired each other to kind of keep writing poetry. Sure. So this was one of the poems that I wrote in that context. So this is like last year. My words dropped like acorn husks, heavy and hollow, hoarded by thieves who stuff them in cheeks and bury them for days bereft of light. I reach into your empty mouth with fingers attempting sleight of hand to manifest oaks from fallen ash. Not a snap nor a gong can yield a forest from a sapling, nor yield a bridge from charred leaves, nor transform your silence into a symphony. If I'm alone in the forest, did I make a sound at all? Thank you.
Rich, do you have a favorite poem or poet that you'd like to read? Anything comes to mind? Anything come to mind?
Gosh, now that you put me on the spot, 5 minutes after we get off the air, you know, I'll think of a million of them. You know,
Rich posted a beautiful one by Rumi the other day.
I'm always posting them. Yeah, I just can't think of any right now. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to offer it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, any final thoughts? What would you like to say in wrapping up here today? I just, you know, this, I don't want to, I don't even know what to say. I do want to say this. I've come to a place in spirituality, spiritual. I don't know. what is practical for me is now what is spiritual, and what is spiritual for me is practical. So like scheduling and routine and taking care of myself with right food and rest and balance. To me, that, you know, one time it was about spiritual heights and penetrating veils and mind states and visions and, you know, messages. And now it's the pinnacle or the manifestation of spirituality right now is really much more grounded in a way that there's no need to, I just need to live my life and take care. I think that's all, not just of others, but myself in ways that are respectful and kind. And I see that as the fruition of the maturation of my spiritual inquiry.
Just from me, I think, you know, that message combined with, you know, what Lisa's saying about maybe, you know, for me, grounding my, you know, this search that I have, this relentless, endless search that I have in my body and in the immediacy of my just becoming aware immediately of where I am physically and even psychologically in a more just sort of visceral way. And as you're sort of suggesting, you know, the Zen, you know, what is it? Chop wood and fetch water, something along that's where enlightenment is or whatever. And maybe that is a good, in some sense, a good narrow lesson for me to focus on. Because believe me, coming from the two most spiritual people, spiritually connected people I know, for me, that's an important one. So I thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And Lisa, I'm just wondering, what do you want to take us out with? What thought or vision or sharing that you want to express to take us out with?
I also feel extremely... I'm a good talker, and but when I really sit with the magnitude of the gift of both of you in my life, I don't have the words. I just feel so, I feel beyond privileged to just have been given the gift of both of you in my life. And that, Joel, to thank you for putting this together and for bringing us together in this space, much, you know, boundless gratitude. And Rich, I just am so grateful that it's been 30 years and we've had quite a journey.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful that you've been a companion on that journey and the many vicissitudes of it. I'm so very grateful for that. So I love you both so dearly, and I just feel humbled and grateful to have you both in my life as teachers and companions. So thank you.